On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
It's time to talk farm with another serious farmer here on Talk Farm to Me. Where else can you have an honest conversation with farmers from coast to coast? This goes well beyond the farmer's market chit-chat and deep into the heart of the matter. I am your host, Dana, or Farm Girl, as I am known on Instagram. You can find me there at XOXO Farm Girl. I like to bring you farmers from all over who grow vegetables, raise animals, have big ideas and opinions that I think you should hear. Some of the farmers you meet here are famous. Most are not. Don't get me started on how I think they should be. Make farmers famous. Hit me up for a sticker or a tote if you agree. Anyway, here, some of the farmers you meet are multi-generational, and others are just starting out. Together, they make up less than 2% of us who farm for the other 98. It's pretty impressive, really. And I believe deeply that we need to know them, to understand them, to empathize with them, and to work with them to make sure our food system is safe and healthy, equitable and profitable, so that it can feed us, our land, and our communities. So as you listen, know that you are a part of this ecosystem, the one where small actions, like listening to a podcast, can have a big impact. Today, we are going to hear from rancher Michaela Mann about two farm businesses. And yes, it is good to think of every farm as a business, because they are, in fact, businesses. D&D Cattle Company and D&D Beef. When you want to know the answer to the age-old question, where's the beef? That's Michaela and her business. Michaela's grandfather, Dwayne, and her father, Dan, started D&D Cattle as a seed stock ranch where ranchers buy bulls to breed with their cows, to spread their seed, so to speak. D&D Cattle raises registered Red Angus and Angus cattle and keeps decades of data on them so you know what you're getting when you buy one. And you might find it interesting that the bulls are raised for docility, kind of like Ferdinand, you remember him from the children's book? And the hot-headed bulls end up heading off, as my good friend John says, to freezer camp. Michaela sells the beef from D&D Cattle direct to consumer in custom boxes and as quarters, halves, and wholes. And when I say that, I mean whole steers and heifers, half steers or heifers, or quarter steers or heifers, butchered into cuts for your freezer. In Nebraska, where both D&Ds operate, folks have big freezers. Michaela and I met through Instagram, where she shares her strong opinions emphatically. Like many farmers and ranchers, she comes under criticism not necessarily for how she and her family run their cattle, but just for raising cattle and selling beef at all. We will talk about buzzwords and loopholes, farmer and food myths, as well as some very specific farmer challenges.
I mean, it's been 50 years ago. My grandpa started selling direct to consumer quarter, halves, and wholes. So we just had like a running list. We'd have some cattle on feed. And when animals were ready for butcher, my grandma Helen had a list in the kitchen and she would just run through the list and see who needed a quarter, half, or whole. I didn't realize how truly uncommon this concept was. Growing up, that was just part of what we did. About 5 years ago now, we had a couple extra fats, steers and heifers that were ready for slaughter. And my dad called me and he's like, hey, can you throw something up on social media? I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I was completely bombarded with the response of people wanting a quarter, half, or whole beef. And that's how I started D&D Beef.
Before she started D&D Beef, the ranch sold bulls at annual sale, and they sold some of their cattle for beef at special feeder sales, where young cattle are purchased and then fed to slaughter weight, or for breeding stock for other ranches.
There's so many different ways to do ranching. Growing up, what we did is we'd keep our replacements, so our bulls and heifers that would be deemed good enough for breeding stock. Either we'd keep them, maybe sell a group of females to another rancher, and then obviously our bull sale every spring. And anything we deemed not good enough quality, when I'm saying quality, the characteristics we think are deemed good for breeding, we would either sell them, take them to, we have a couple sale barns close, and they'll do what's called a special feeder sale. So it's like a special day when feedlots come and buy cattle, or other ranchers buy cattle, or people like down south buy cattle to run on grass. It's just, they know it's a special feeder sale. And then we also used to retain ownership at a very small feedlot where we would own the cattle. They'd feed them for us. And then we also would get carcass data back so we could see how our cattle graded when they would take them to a larger slaughterhouse to be processed. So yes, we still market the conventional route, but as my business has grown, we are selling less and less out into the market, and I'm feeding more and more for D&D beef.
In addition to quarter, half, and whole beef quantities, Michaela ships smaller quantities to customers who order online via dndbeef.com. Here's a little peek into how she handles her business.
I do sell a lot of quarter, halves, and wholes, as well as ship nationwide, break it down. I'll do my club boxes, my weekly special boxes, kind of like, you know, in the winter, I'm selling like a roast box special kind of thing, as well as individual cuts. But I do sell a lot of quarter, halves, and wholes, which I'm grateful for. And I do think I'm fortunate in the fact that there's a lot of people around here who do it.
And so they probably need to have some sort of infrastructure, like a big freezer.
If you have like a small chest freezer, like the small ones that look like a half a fridge, most people you can get a quarter, and then you need like a bigger chest freezer to get a half, or obviously a whole. I do it the old school way, where when people buy shares from me, they still have complete control how they want it processed. We're still old school. That's how I grew up.
And you have one butcher that you work with. You're not doing it on premises. You're not doing it yourself.
What I am asking here is if she has her own facility. More and more of the established farmers that I talk to are setting up their own slaughter facilities, or abattoirs, to control the process from breeding to market. And such facilities have to be USDA certified in order to sell the meat.
No, I have one main butcher that I do for online sales. As my business has grown, I actually have to use three now during my beef shares seasons, what I call it. I'm also fortunate that I can think of like six butchers that are within an hour and a half, 2 hour driving distance.
This is a big issue nationwide for smaller ranchers. Having access to a butcher whose work you like, whose facility you respect, and who can fit you into their schedule is a big issue. There just aren't enough of them around.
Demand is still really high. They were not necessarily hard to get into. You still had to plan ahead pre-pandemic, but now obviously it's still kind of hard to get into a couple of them, and especially just because of a volume of what I'm doing.
I know that across the country, a lot of ranchers and farmers, especially out east, were having trouble finding a slaughterhouse and a slot, and USDA places, especially the smaller ones, were closing. So they were really having challenges and having to drive further, which, as you know, with gas prices, has been an added expense that people have really been struggling with.
Yes, it's hard.
And your customers, I just want to talk about a little bit like where your customers and how you raise your beef and finish them. How does that come together? Are they asking for new things? You talk a lot about buzzwords, and there's pasture raised and grass finished or grain finished, and sometimes those definitions can be slippery. So I'm just curious where the rubber is hitting the road between what your customers want and how you're doing things.
I always tell people, if you want grass finished, that's fine. If you want grain finished, that's fine. I will send you to somebody. The more the merrier. There's a million ways to do this. And that's one thing that I think is really confusing to consumers.
It is confusing, right? Do you want grass-finished beef? Do you know why you want that? You heard about it somewhere and you have it in your head that you'd prefer that, or maybe you tried it and you liked it. Okay, so how do you know the animal your meat comes from was raised that way? We will get to labels in a little bit. You talk to your farmer or your rancher. That's the best way. And that takes some effort from you to find your farmer, even if she lives in a different state than you do, like Michaela in Nebraska. With beef, you have these options. And like Michaela says, the more the merrier. You can find a rancher who raises their cattle the way you want it. Wagyu, yep, Angus, Raised on mother's milk and grass only? Sure. But you know what? Unless you know a small independent farmer who raises hogs and chickens, you don't have the same freedom of choice with pork and chicken. It's much more challenging to get what you want. Here's why.
Yes, there's some pork and poultry people who are doing like what we're doing, but pork and poultry got vertically integrated, right? Like if you look at the mass amount of pork and poultry made, the majority is vertically integrated, as in, like, you know, everybody has contracts.
Explain what you mean by vertically integrated.
So when I was growing up, you could still take hogs to the sale barns around here. There's no hogs being sold at sale barns around here anymore, because if you raise hogs, there's a really good chance you're already contracted with Tyson or Hormel or something to process your hogs. Cattle ranching and farming is not vertically integrated. I don't have a contract with so-and-so for my animals since birth. Pork and poultry do. And the big guys, the majority of them, I know there's people doing it small, and that's awesome. I'm just talking in general. So when my husband and I were growing up, they'd be, you know, hogs on Wednesday, cattle on Thursday. There's no hog sales at sale barns anymore, just because if you have hogs, which are still family owned, they're contracted in with these bigger meat processors, because that's who processes all the pork. So chances of them, they all kind of are feeding the same. And it's a consistency thing, because they want the same product, the end product that you and I are used to getting at the grocery store.
I don't want to get into this too much here, but when Michaela talks about expectations, our expectations as consumers at the grocery store, it's an important point. We are driving the industry with our demand, and that means we can change it. It's a thought I would like you to keep in your head. I promise to come back to it in another episode.
But you can kind of use more general terms for how pork and poultry are raised. They're in a confined CAFO, which, once again, that's how it's done. They're born here. They stay here for a little bit, and then they're finished here. Everybody kind of knows the process.
Okay, CAFO. That is a concentrated animal feeding operation. You probably know that. But that means hogs in small pens, chickens in small pens for their whole lives. It's how it's done. Okay, now back to cattle.
The problem, which is also a really good thing with ranching, is it's so different. We raise our cattle different from my neighbor, who is literally 4 miles down the road from us, where if you go to a place where there's a lot of hog barns and units, they're all kind of doing it the same.
Can you explain how, like, just give me a comparison, how you're doing it and how your neighbor's doing it so that I understand?
So what I'm saying is we wean at a different day, right? So maybe we keep them on the cow, like the calves, for example, might be run on grass a little longer. Maybe my neighbor is dry lotting their cows. So we're in a really bad drought in Nebraska, extreme. And so maybe my neighbor is feeding more of a silage-based diet right now. So that's the entire corn plant chopped up with corn, and where we're just feeding maybe some ground hay. There's so many different variations in how ranchers handle their cattle, just because of resources, feed, land, space, that it's so not cookie cutter. So when consumers are asking me questions, I try to answer as clean as possible, but it's so different, which is awesome, is ranchers just do it so different. It's kind of overwhelming, but I think it's a really cool thing, because also we have byproducts, corn byproducts. Obviously, there's a lot of corn in the state of Nebraska. So there's distiller grains. So those are byproducts when they're processing corn. I'm only 25 minutes from one of the biggest Cargills in the country. So a lot of feedlot in the area use distillers, and we buy pelleted distillers. So that's the byproduct that Cargill produces after it extracts whatever from the corn for whatever they're making that day, and it high quality, it's high in fat and protein. So we feed it to our young cows because they're growing, they need a little extra. So this is awesome byproduct that years ago, what were they doing with it? Then there's ranchers up north. My friend lives in Minnesota. They feed their cattle beet pulp, the leftover from them harvesting the beets, right? So she has a stockpile of beet pulp that she's feeding her cattle. And then another friend of mine lives out west and they feed some of their cattle some, I think it's almond hulls from almond harvest. So I know that's a lot of information, but that's just like one of the things, like it's so awesome, but it can be so confusing for the consumer because there's not one way that everybody does this.
It's so interesting to think about what cattle eat and what they can eat. Even when they are grazing in a big green meadow, they eat the stuff that no other animals can eat. They can graze on land that is good for nothing else, on hillsides and plains. Let's get back to the consumer, you and me, for a minute. We are interesting too, right? We get a bee in our bonnets about a certain cut of meat or how an animal is raised or what it eats, and that's what we shop for. I will confess to buying grass-finished beef and not really having any idea what that means. I mean, grass sounds good for cows, right? It sounds natural. But do we really know? And even when we don't know, we hear about a trend and we vote with our dollars, and that gives us a lot of power.
And a lot of people be like, you know, pasture-raised, which is just kind of a, most cattle are pasture-raised. I didn't realize how many people think that cattle are born in feedlots, which is the furthest thing from the truth. Feedlots are just a finishing. So that pasture-raised was basically ranchers' way of saying, like, they're actually born on our ranch and stay here until, you know, they go and be finished or stay at their ranch and finished. And then the grass-finished thing's funny. Grass-finished doesn't mean they're out on pasture. I can grass-finish my cattle. If I'm going to grass finish them, they're going to be in a pen for, you know, however long that takes. And grass finished isn't necessarily grass. That's alfalfa. That could be haylage. It's all these types of forage-based feed. If that's really a concern for where you're buying your beef, you need to actually ask and kind of know what to look for or ask. Because down south, like in Kansas and Oklahoma, you can grass finish year-round. Technically, they'll put cattle on wheat pasture and stuff that's technically irrigated. And they run stockers down there. So those are calves that are weaned, that they're just getting to a larger weight before they enter a feedlot. So those guys are on grass, the forage, longer than we're able to in Nebraska because it's frozen and it's snowing and we don't grow. We can't grow this time of year. So it's just like a can of worms, and in a good way, but it can be so complicated because it's not cookie cutter, which is awesome because we're able to do these things. So that's when I try to just share like grass finished and grain finished and all these things. I can have my cattle on pasture year round, but still be feeding them a corn-based diet. I could just have them out on pasture right now, you know? So lots of little words that kind of bother me that some people are using. And I think it's like, I don't want to say a false advertising, but it's adding to the confusion to the consumer.
I see how it can be confusing because everybody does it their own way. When you're finishing your cattle, you're doing it at your ranch or they're going to a feedlot. You do it at your ranch.
Yes, we do it at our ranch. So like I said, we've done it before and we built more pens at my husband and I's place. So we're down the road from my parents and we actually finish them by ourselves and we feed them a corn-based diet the last, you know, however many months prior to harvest. And then they have free choice hay. So that's where we'll put like a hay bale in the pen. We're not doing like the feedlot ration or the total mix ration where you're grinding feed and putting in grain and like distillers or something popular in our area. We're still doing it the old school way that we did it when I was growing up. It's a very expensive way to feed cattle. We're doing it wrong, but that's how the quality of the feed and the end product is why we're doing it this way, because we believe taste and stuff that it's better to do it this way.
Obviously, there's consumers trying to educate themselves and really understand what you've just explained. I think it's important for people to understand that. It's not cookie cutter. So that's a learning curve for a consumer. But you and other ranchers and farmers are also at the receiving end of attacks that are beyond trying to understand where their beef is coming from. Can you talk a little bit about what you hear and what comes your way?
Oh, there's two groups, usually. One is your animal activists, your extremists and stuff. And those are telling me I'm a terrible person and I'm raising like a terrible human and my son's going to be a murderer and all these things, which really, if they knew how upset my kids are getting in a good way, they are already understanding like the frustration when we try and try and try to save something and it doesn't work. And they're understanding the life cycle of what we're doing and such, but that's usually the animal extremist.
She's referring to calving mostly. It's not uncommon for a rancher to have to step in and help birth a calf or to help a calf after it's been born. And it doesn't always work out. Ranchers live that reality, and ranch families live it too, including the kids. It's a strong lesson from an early age. But animal activists aren't the only critics. Some of it comes from the farming community, too.
I've found a lot lately, there's been a lot of people, grass finish is the only way, and the way in which we're doing it is wrong, and I'm poisoning people by feeding my cattle grain, and it's just a lot of misconception with what's going on, and there's no, once again, I've tried sometimes to have a conversation, but a lot of times they just want to spout off and not listen. I'm not a lecturer by any means. When I share my information, this is the what and the why, and that's it. But a lot of times it's just been a lot of misconception about how we're raising them and what we're doing, and just basically telling me I'm doing it wrong on a regular basis. It's been a little crazy. A day or two a week, I'll get bombarded with people. It hasn't been terrible, but usually a day or two, I will get some crazy comments and such, and it is what it is. But
so you said there were two groups. One is the animal activists. Who's the other group?
I have noticed that it's a lot of farmers and ranchers that feel that their way is the right way and the only way, which that one is a little more frustrating because I'm like, we should be promoting and sharing the what and why we do what we do and not really doing this bashing thing. The buzzwords we talked about earlier, that regenerative and sustainable, everybody's doing that. There's just different levels of it. And I think they're the ones who are really investing in that, which is great. But then they assume that everybody who's not to the extreme in which that they're practicing this, then we're all wrong and we're ruining the world, which that bothers me because we've been doing this forever before it was buzzwords. You know, this isn't anything new to us. We've been doing rotational grazing. We spread manure on our pastures. We do rotational crops. This isn't something new. This is something that many of us have been doing already.
And there are a lot of myths out there. And I wanted to just talk to you about what your top three myths are that we should be debunking.
Well, I always like to share the myth that red meat is bad for you. That one drives me crazy. I don't know. There may be like 15 to 20 days a year that I don't eat red meat at least once a day. And that's one thing that I found, which I think was kind of cool with the keto movement, was it was more so just talking about you guys, like protein's good for you. And not only is protein good for you, beef is, I think a ribeye is like a multivitamin. Like if you could pick one cut of beef, I think the ribeye is the best because of all the vitamins, minerals, protein content, fat content, like a ribeye is one of the best cuts for you in general. Just talking about, you know, your zinc and your vitamin B12 and selenium and all these things that we don't really pay attention to, which also blows my mind because we're so exact with our cattle's diet.
According to leading nutritionist Diana Rogers, a 4-ounce ribeye has 230 calories and 35 grams of protein, plus iron, zinc, B vitamins, and more. And to match that equivalent with rice and beans, you would need to consume 600 calories.
Like Peggy, sure, they hit everything. And then us as humans, we're like, eh, you know. So I think one of the myths is just how good protein is for you, especially beef, where there was this push, you know, years ago, chicken's the best because it's, you know, no fat. But it was this clean meat.
I just want to acknowledge this clean meat thought for a second. You've probably seen cookbooks talk about chicken as the clean meat. And you may remember the marketing campaign, pork, the other white meat, yes? Well, it plays a not-so-palatable angle where white meat is good meat, without scientific backing. I'm going to share an article from nutritionist Diana Rogers in the show notes so that you can dive into the complexity of all of this on your own. I hope to have her on the show in the future so we can address this head on.
Right. Well, from a nutrient standpoint, besides protein, which is good for you, you're not getting the rest of your vitamins and minerals when you are compared to beef. So that's one thing that I've really enjoyed. Just like I said, with the keto movement, is just watching all these doctors being like, you guys, come on, like eat some beef. So that's one myth that I just kind of casually try to share how good beef is for you. Another myth is the environment concept, that we're living in the environment and the world is ending and cattle are causing global warming is exhausting. It drives me crazy. I've shared statistics about, you know, the methane emissions that cattle produce, breakdown in the environment. I think it's in 10 years or 12 years.
Here's the deal. Michaela is right. Cattle-produced methane breaks down in 10 years and works its way back to the earth in the form of rain. What's more, that is biological carbon, which comes from the natural process of eating grass and not, by contrast, with the fossil fuel industry, where carbon is released from extracting oil and gas from deep under the Earth's surface. There's a difference. Critics love to cite the EPA statistic that 10% of greenhouse gases come from agriculture. The leading chunk of that pie is transportation at 28%, followed by the electric power industry and residential or commercial emissions, and then agriculture. Critics also like to zero in on bovine belches, and the nuance gets lost in the headline. Part of the issue is not the animal per se, but how we contain them in vast feedlots in their own manure in mass. This is a topic for another episode, and we will be talking carbon very soon. So stay tuned.
Can't compare that to cars or transportation. And beef's ruining the environment, and people driving to Target every day to get an item that they forgot, or not using reusable products, and your Starbucks cup you're getting every day, and buying cheap clothes that you have to throw away after a year, you know, that's not the problem. This animal over here grazing and providing you the most nutrient-dense proteins possible, that's the problem, not us. This is the problem, and that drives me crazy as well, because we're wasteful humans. What, the United States throws away 40% of the food it produces? But it's beef's fault. So that's another myth that drives me a little bonkers too. That's a big uphill battle that surprises me, that with all the statistics and stuff that have come out showing this, I don't understand why, you know, taxing methane emissions from cattle is going to fix our problem. No, it's not. It's not at all. So that's the second myth. And then I think the third myth is just animal care and animal welfare. I mean, I've seen my dad give CPR to calves, right? I have seen the lengths we go to raise our livestock. I'm talking everybody, pork, poultry, dairy, I don't care who you are. A good herdsman, it kills you. And I say that in the nicest way possible. Like, they don't understand the lengths we go to, how we feed them before we feed ourselves, how we run ourselves ragged to do this for barely any money. And I'm talking your average rancher, you know, selling on the board. We're feeding the world and we're going broke doing it. It's like the wear and tear that ranchers and cattlemen, especially, as well as pork and poultry producers and dairy, my goodness, the lengths we go to, how we run our bodies ragged and down to go broke feeding the world, is in how much we care. It's really hard to portray in an appropriate way where people can grasp it, but it's just, we care so much. They just think this is just a 8-to-5 job and we don't care. They have no idea how much we truly, truly care for what we're, the animals we're raising.
You mentioned something maybe on social media about meat conglomerates versus family farms. I want to understand what your perspective is from your side on, you say 4 or 5 conglomerates, and I don't want to say versus, but versus the family farms.
Well, and I will say too, you're big guys, right? They're still buying cattle from guys like us. So that's the one thing, this goes back to me being like, and this is what I always share, like, if you're buying beef in the grocery store, it's still okay. It's still coming from ranchers like us. I just want to say at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with the grocery store because you're still supporting a rancher, especially if it's from America, as it's here and stuff. You're still supporting my neighbor down the road who only sells maybe a dozen quarter halves and wholes. The rest of their hundreds and hundreds ahead are being sold through the normal market chains. They're still important to ranchers across the country. Yeah, it all comes from a family. Of course it does, because like I told you, we're not contracted in like some of the other meat production is. So it affects the family maybe in a different way that's buying, you know, the JBS or the Cargill or whoever, where they're making hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars off of one animal where the producer's barely making anything. So some of those businesses and stuff, I do think they maybe started good, had good intentions, but now it's kind of a marketing scheme because of the movement, like you're saying, to support local, where you just don't know how much local they're really supporting.
When I go to the supermarket to buy beef, how do I know it's from a U.S. ranch?
Some places are putting labels on it, and there's actually something that they're actually changing, trying to change right now, the law. Some brands put stickers on it and some don't, but there was this loophole that they could ship in carcasses from Canada and stuff and then process them here and repackage them and saying that they were harvested in the United States. So that's one loophole.
Michaela brings up an interesting point. It's definitely a can of worms because recently in the news, the labeling of beef, particularly ground beef, has come under scrutiny. Beef raised and slaughtered in other countries can apparently be imported and labeled as a product of the USA. I'm going to look into this further, but you as a consumer need to be aware of two things. One, that this kind of misleading labeling exists, and two, that you have the power to demand that it be rectified.
Yeah, and that's one thing too I always suggest to people, like, go ask the meat counter. Like, hey, do you know, like, not even necessarily the stuff that they're cutting, but like over here, do you know, is there anything local? Because a lot of places are trying to get local, trying to do that. So the options there, it just might take a little bit of legwork to sift through the labels, unfortunately.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the challenges that farmers and ranchers face. And I know we talked about some of them in terms of people coming at you for questioning your practices and how you do your work.
There's a million of them.
There's a million of them. Let's talk about a couple of them.
For us right now, we're in a really bad drought. So that's just like, if, you know, a list in my head, that drought is just like right here.
Tell me specifically how the drought is impacting your work.
So we had to feed hay in July. We don't usually feed hay until cows are off corn stalks last year. So we started feeding hay in July on pasture. We had to wean a month and a half early. So weaning is where we do fence line weaning, where you separate the mom and the calf. Usually our practice is how we do it. We wean them the end of August. Usually the calves are only nursing morning and night. Think of it like if you were a breastfeeding mom when your kid's really not consuming much milk anymore and they're basically eating all the other food. That's when we wean. They're maybe nursing morning and night. And we would fence line wean usually the end of August, and we were feeding hay the beginning of July. One cow eats one bale per month. So just to put it into perspective, when you're feeding a lot of cows, that's a lot of hay. You just like burn through it is what it feels like. So the drought affected hay, corn, pasture. Pastures are way shorter than they should be. So we have barely received any moisture this year. We're hoping to get some rain. So if we don't get rain, and we've had a little bit of snow, but not a lot, I don't know when pasture turnout will be this spring. So it's just this constant like state of the unknown, as well as just from that perspective. So then feed prices are going up. So when I'm saying feed, I'm talking all cattle feed. I'm not talking grain. I'm talking hay, everything, right? So all the prices of that goes up. Also, if you think about it this way, it takes from birth to butcher 18 months, right? That's not including the cow's gestation. So when you have this drought happen to ranchers, it's not just the year of the drought. It's like this whole encompassing window. So we're a good year into the drought. So that affected last year's calf crop, the calf in that cow, and then it's going to be this year. So it's not just the one year. There's so many pieces to the puzzle. It takes a long time to catch up. It's not like you just had an expensive month is what I'm trying to say. It just adds up. COVID has really put farmers and ranchers through the ringer. Fuel prices, you still can't get parts for certain things. Like now I know when somebody like has a tractor that needs fixed, there's a new joke. Like you don't take it in because you don't know when you'll get it back. You just keep trying to make it work until they can get that part in. COVID really kind of made things hard just in the fact of like the fuel prices and the parts and equipment. And for example, like a hay feeder has doubled in price, like your round hay bale feeder. It's just unbelievable how expensive everything is. So just the added cost of everything has been really hard, as well as, you know, you'll hear the stories about with COVID and such, the packers making all the money and the ranchers weren't making very much. So it's another thing that a lot of people don't realize too, is like, just because the prices have increased, it doesn't mean that when you're selling your cattle the conventional route, we haven't caught up yet in our payout. Somebody sells their calves in the fall, the input costs are so high, it's been a struggle as well to recoup that from a market standpoint.
This struggle, the economic one, is a thread I hear in nearly every conversation with farmers. You do all the hard work and your payday doesn't reflect that work or the value of your products. I don't think I will ever forget Michaela's words that we, consumers in general, don't understand the lengths that our average farmers and ranchers go to in order to feed us for barely any money, that they are basically going broke feeding us. That should change, don't you think? I believe that we have the power to change this. It's amazing what you can learn about really important elements of your own life from talking with a farmer or a rancher like Michaela. Raising two littles and selling beef direct from her family's farm, D&D cattle, via D&D beef. If you're going to take a few things away from this conversation, maybe it's that cattle farming is way different from farming chicken and pork. No one rancher does it the same way as any other. And it's worth it to you to get to know your farmer and rancher wherever you are. It's also a good idea to have a conversation with yourself about your own preferences and what you want from the beef that you eat and why. I think too often we hitch our wagons, mine included, to a new idea or buzzword without really knowing what it means. In the show notes, I am leaving you some links to a couple of articles. And since this episode brought up so many interesting threads, stay tuned as we make our way through them, from carbon emissions to the humane treatment of animals in the agriculture industry, and hopefully a conversation with nutritionist, farmer, and meat-eating advocate Diana Rogers. Thank you for being here with me today on Talk Farm to Me, where you hear honest conversations with serious farmers who produce everything from food to fiber to fuel, all in under an hour. Pretty cool, huh? I'm your host, Dana, or Farm Girl, and I look forward to being with you again soon. And since you are here, if you found this episode interesting, which I'm pretty sure you did, please do me a favor and share it with a friend. Talk farm with you soon.